Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my just absolute pleasure to welcome back to the Salieri Report, a man who needs no introduction. Richard Dolan is working away on a new book on false flags, and I said, ugh, I have to get him to talk about that. We can't wait for the book. So he's coming in today from Rochester, New York. So, Richard, welcome to the Salieri Report.
Hi, Catherine. Thank you so much for having me on again. I've always enjoyed talking with you under any circumstances. We've done a lot of different things together. And I think that you are the first person to want to interview me about this new project that I'm working on.
Well, I think this is very important because I think I'm watching an unprecedented amount of people losing time and money to the distractions of, you know, whether it's false flags in the physical or in the digital. So to me, it's very important. But why don't you start by telling us why you've decided to write a book on this topic? Where'd the interest come from? How did this happen?
Yeah. Well, for 20 plus years, I've been writing about UFOs and related conspiratorial activities to that. And that takes you deep enough into the world of covert and clandestine activity, to say the very least. And, you know, even before I was doing the UFO analysis, UFO research, I have always been interested primarily in trying to understand geopolitics and the true structure of power on this planet of ours. And I actually don't specifically remember when the idea crystallized that I wanted to do a false flag book. I've always kept a list of book projects in like a separate folder. And this was one of them. I had a couple of other ones, and I may actually tackle them. But it was about 1 year ago, actually, that I was talking about my book projects with a friend of mine, actually a very lovely woman in England. And I mentioned this one and then that one, and then I mentioned my false flag project that I was leaning toward anyway. And she said, "Darling," just how she talked, "you must do the false flag book." She was so adamant. And it actually stopped me in my track because I realized that this subject, it hits a nerve. It's not just the thing with me. Like, all of my book projects are like these little private things that I'm interested in. But the false flag subject, this is something that everyone is interested in. And since I've started really diving into it, I've seen that this is touching a raw nerve. And the more I've thrown myself into it, I realize this is a really important subject to be dealing with.
Yes.
Because as I have concluded, we live in an era of false flags.
Yes.
One of the things that I found in, like, you know, when you search on the web and you Google for false flag, you get millions of hits. But actually, many of those are pretty much copy and paste from the same site, the same phrases, the same kind of truisms, and not all of them are really true. So one of the things that when I was going into this, I kept reading on websites the statement, well, this goes back throughout human history. And I was willing to accept that. I thought, well, okay, ancient false flags. But what I really have decided is that the false flag, the proper false flag, is a distinctively modern phenomenon. It's actually not an ancient phenomenon, not in a serious way. That doesn't mean that people in ancient times were not above lying and deception. Of course they did that. But when we're talking about a false flag, we're talking about something, it's a particularly pernicious form of deception. And in fact, I think that we need to understand why it's a modern phenomenon specifically so that we are actually better able to see these things when they come down the pike. And one of the things that I noticed in doing this research, and I'm not done, I need to emphasize, I have a lot of information I've gathered already, but there's more. I mean, the book's not done. But I can already see that this is a phenomenon that has gone through a serious evolution and development over the past century. That's really what we have to say about it. It's not what it was back when, you know, the Nazis probably did the Reichstag fire, or when the Japanese did a false flag in Manchuria, or, you know what I mean, those types of early types of false flags. And they're real, and they were despicable, but what we're dealing with today is actually orders of magnitude of greater sophistication. And they're not simply military. They are. They are military still, but they're not solely military. There's, you know, what you really have with a false flag is you have the creation of an event which creates a false enemy, right?
Yeah, you have a theater.
Yeah, it's exactly. It's a problem, reaction, solution type of scenario where you create a false problem. It's a real problem, but it's created by you, and then implicating another party, whether this is terrorists or another nation, and then with an obvious solution, which is typically these days to pass pernicious laws that could not otherwise be passed, or institute invasions of other countries to steal their resources, which could not otherwise be justified. So that's really what you're looking at. And the other thing I guess I'll say, and I feel maybe I'm bouncing around a little bit, but I've been saying this lately, if there's an Olympics of false flags in the modern era, my feeling is that the United States would get the gold, Israel would get the silver, and Britain would get the bronze. And so what you're looking at, the U.S. and its key geostrategic allies seem to be doing the bulk of the false flag, not Russia, by the way. And then it's not that Russia hasn't done them. I believe that in 1999, during the Chechen wars, there's very good evidence that the FSB under Putin, by the way, was doing some of the bombings, blaming it on the Chechens, and which lifted him into power. They're not above it. But when you're really looking at the bulk of them, it's really U.S., Israel, and Britain that seem to be doing the most. And that got me thinking, like, well, why would this be? Why would the United States?
We seem to have brought the sort of the Hollywood multimedia integration with false flags to a whole new level. You know, we have the Hollywood, we have reality TV, we have social media, we have, you know, we just have a way of going at it, which is very 360 degree and cross sector. That's quite remarkable. Let's step back for a second and just define what a false flag is, because I think it's very intriguing where the term comes from.
Absolutely. If anyone has seen the movie Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, Johnny Depp doing his Keith Richard impression on the ship there. You know, back in those days, the 17th and 18th century, pirates did use flags of other nations to lure merchant vessels toward them. So that was literally a false flag. So you'd have the flag of Brittany, a flag of the Netherlands, flag of France, and so forth. And you bring a merchant vessel out on the high seas close to you. And then inevitably what the pirates would do is then raise the black pirate flag, scare the hell out of the merchant vessel. And then they would know, the pirates are here. They've come to steal our stuff. And the pirates would rob them blind. Now, when you really – and this actually did happen historians, you know, will typically say, oh, yes, it was a thing that pirates did. We don't really have more than a handful of these examples specifically, but they did happen. And it did seem to be somewhat widespread from time to time. So what's interesting to me about that is that the pirates had more honor in what they did than modern countries do today. I mean, honestly,
right.
Because, you know, at least – by the time they got to you, you knew they were pirates. You knew
right.
They were really going to be robbing from you. But that was the phrase. And, in fact, there are some possible false flag types of events that took place even earlier than the pirates. I mean, sometimes people ascribe the burning of Rome as a false flag. You know, the idea being that Nero, the emperor, wanted to build a new temple complex in the center of Rome, and the Roman Senate was kind of pushing up against that. Rome did burn, I mean, significantly burned, and he then, in the ruins of that, put his temple up. It was an argument that came out at the time. Actually, Nero was accused of having that done. The problem is, when you look at the primary sources, it's not the best argument in the world. It seems like he probably didn't do it, but the fact is we'll never really know. And this is the problem with some of the ancient claims. When you, but really, as you get into the modern era, you realize reason that there are not many examples of ancient false flags is that the pieces were not really truly in place. And one of the main things you need is a functioning medium that can actually get the word out. And what we see, the first true false flag in modern times is actually earlier than people realize, and it's from the year 1788. At least this is the earliest one that I found, by Sweden against Russia.
Oh, this is when the guy from the opera made the military uniforms?
Yeah, you knew about
that.
And, it's exactly right. So the Swedish king, I'll be real quick with this, king named Gustav, didn't seem to be the brightest bulb out there, frankly. And I think he was manipulated by Britain, France, and the Netherlands into provoking Russia for their own reasons. Russia was at war in the south against the Ottoman Turks. So they convinced him that, it was like wag the dog. They said, look, you're not popular, but a war could really buck up your popularity. He's like, so he tells the head tailor of the Royal Opera House in Sweden to make a series of Russian Cossack uniforms, and which they did. And they staged a border incident on the border of Finland and Russia. Back then, Finland was part of the Swedish kingdom. And what ensued was a three-year war that was totally ruinous to Sweden. It actually was a really bad idea. But that was a false flag. And, it's interesting, at that time, they used the Swedish newspapers to promote this. There were individuals in Sweden who were very distrustful of that event. So in other words, the equivalent of truthers back then in 1788 who did not believe the official party line, but they were essentially drowned out. So Sweden had the war, and that's possibly the first like international military false flag that I'm aware of in the modern era. Not much in the 19th century, and then we start getting into the 20th century, and it starts getting really intense because I think we're getting to a point where media and the capability and the sophistication of being able to do this really increases. So you got military false flags by Japan in the 30s. They had their own motivation. They wanted to remake Asia in their image, and they needed justifications, pretexts. Russia, Soviet Union did the same thing, and then in 1939, Germany did that against Poland. Meanwhile, you start getting false flags against domestic populations, and this is a new development. You get Germany almost certainly in 1933 doing the Reichstag. I say certainly almost because this is the problem of researching a false flag. If it's done well, you know, you've got very, very good teams of covert operatives involved. And the fact is most of these people are good at what they do, and they're good at covering their tracks, so that even today, now it's 80-plus years later, there are historians who debate this, whether the Germans did it or whether the Dutch communist van der Lubbe did it by himself, maybe with a little bit of German encouragement, maybe not. I would say the majority consensus is that the Nazis were behind it. There was an admission after the war by Hermann Göring to that effect, and it really does look suspicious. It looks like they did it. Essentially, that was Germany's 9/11. It was the torching of their parliament, the Reichstag, and blamed on the communists, used by Hitler to pass what was known as the Enabling Act, and that was their version of the Patriot Act. Essentially, it gave Hitler even more, emergency powers, and it was the foundation for his dictatorship. So that, I think we can say, was with virtually certainty a false flag. And there were some of these during the war. I think the false flag phenomenon really took off and became kind of airborne after the Second World War, during the Cold War. And this is when the United States really came into its own as the perpetrator of false flags. So what you have, for example, are we got a lot of these things. So there was a really particularly pernicious one that we know about. It's totally confirmed, known as Operation Gladio. People, I encourage everyone to Google these, look them up. There's some very interesting Gladio interviews on YouTube with the perpetrators of these events. So the basic bottom line of this was after World War II, the United States, one of its concerns was that the Russians might overrun Europe, particularly after the U.S. demobilized. Russia did not very quickly demobilize. They had a lot more tank formations divisions out there in Europe and America, and the fear was, well, what if they just roll over Europe? What would we do? Well, one plan was, well, we'll do kind of like what the French did during the resistance or what the Yugoslavs did during the resistance. You have kind of you have cells, you know, in these countries. And so what NATO was doing, the U.S. and then NATO was training, cells in various countries. Now, what we know about is the version in Italy. So they trained covert operatives, basically assassination teams and commandos and guerrillas, to operate. If the Russians were to take over, these guys would do their thing. Well, the problem with that plan was that the Russians never took over Italy. They never rolled their tanks into the Western Europe. So what do you do with all these, with these operatives? Well, what the guys in Italy are known to have done is they, and this is with knowledge of NATO itself. Now, how far up it goes, there's a question. There's a lot of deniability. But these guys would bomb train stations, killing hundreds of people in Bologna and I think Milan and other places where, I mean, hundreds of people would die. These were blamed on communists, blamed on basically left-leaning groups. And they were very explicit. After the whole thing got found out, this went on for years, went on for decades. The whole purpose was to manipulate Italian politics and bring it to the right. And
you see, I always thought the core goal of Gladio, and this is just my opinion, is at the end of World War II, the Vatican asked the CIA to help them rig the Italian and European elections. And I think they weren't afraid of the Russians. I think they were afraid of, you know, more socialistic policies taking hold of the government budgets.
Well, I'm not arguing.
And that's what you said. They were trying to move it to the right and keep it in the right. So they're trying to just keep centralized, top-down control of the economy and the government money.
I don't argue against that. I mean, their official justification was the Russian invasion. You create these guerrilla teams. But no, I think, I mean, look, how long did it really take for them to morph into this thing? The Italian elections were rigged. I think that was 1948, if I'm not mistaken. So by that time, I think without a question, I agree with you. I think I don't think it took long before they realized, yeah, we're going to mess around with the socialists, and I think that's what they did. But you know what's interesting is simply the amount of people that they killed, and these were not on the scale of a 9/11, all right, but they were a series of bombings that went on for years and years and years, and kept this kind of fear in the population and really did successfully help turn a lot of people away from the socialists, who were perceived as very violent. And in fact, they weren't the violent ones. It was the Gladio operatives who were violent. There are a number of these things that went on throughout Europe in the 1950s and 60s. A number of them seem to have been these NATO-type operations. Then Mossad gets into the mix by the late 1960s and 70s. There are a number of nearly certainly proven Mossad operations in Paris in the 1970s and 80s that looked a lot like Charlie Hebdo, by the way. And I'm not saying...
Now, how many of these were things Mossad was doing on its own, or Mossad was doing at the request of Britain or the U.S. or...
Tough to know all of these. I'll give you a perfect example of where it really gets tangled up, which is the 1986 bombing of Libya. I'm sure a lot of people listening remember this. Now, one thing that I've learned in my research, and this is a claim, but I think it's a very well-documented claim, and I'll be discussing this at length in my book. The official story of why the United States bombed Libya back in April 1986 was that the NSA, or U.S. intelligence, I think NSA, intercepted codes coming out of Libya, going to Libyan embassies around the world, basically providing instructions on how to implement terrorist activity. And then secondarily, or separately, they believe they had Libyan fingerprints on a bombing at a Berlin discotheque in the spring of 1986, which killed a lot of people, including two U.S. servicemen. And so Ronald Reagan goes on the TV and says, this is the reason. We've got proof. In fact, I think he said our Israeli allies helped us in gathering some of this evidence up, and were going in and they bombed Libya and nearly killed Gaddafi, but they didn't. They killed some family members and did some damage. So that's the pretext. And what the what some independent research has now argued, I think persuasively, is that this was a Mossad operation all along. Mossad wanted Gaddafi out even back in the 80s. They wanted him gone. And they sent a team of operatives into Libya secretly. It was all covert ops under different identities. They rented an apartment in Tripoli for a certain period of time. Mossad had the encrypted Libyan diplomatic codes. They had access to the Libyan encryption, I guess is a better way to put it. And they were the ones who put out encrypted messages to Libyan embassies implicating Libyans in global terrorism, knowing that the United States NSA would intercept these codes. And secondarily, the bombing in Berlin was also attributed as a Mossad operation. This is one of these cases in the false flag where, I mean, there are false flags that are proven, and there are false flags that are due to, I think, very good investigation, something that a rational mind would say, yes, that is exactly, that's the most persuasive argument. And I think that is what happened with Libya. I think the Israelis, they're undoubtedly U.S. Individuals within NSA or CIA or other areas of the intelligence community that probably were in on this. I'm sure they knew about this.
Right, but not everybody.
No, right, and that's always the question with these things. But they had their agenda. So in that sense, you really could say Israel was using the United States as its bully, as its schoolyard bully to go after Gaddafi. A couple of other cases of Mossad doing these bombings. I don't have these right in front of me, but there are a couple in the late 70s and early 80s in Paris. This is what made me think of Charlie Hebdo. There were three separate ones that I know of. One was of a Jewish delicatessen or like a Jewish bakery, I think a deli. One was of a manufacturing facility that was making nuclear technology, not weapons, but nuclear technology for Iraq. This was in France. And then there was one other. So one of these was attributed to neo-Nazi groups. One was attributed to Arabs, and the nuclear one was attributed to eco-terrorists. And in the case of actually of all three of these, what I learned in the research was that French police would be investigating these things and run into, boom, this brick wall. Once
right.
They started thinking, this looks suspicious, this looks like it has Mossad connections, and then the investigations essentially would stop. So again, we don't have what you and I and other people would like to consider hard proof. That's the problem.
I don't know if you've ever seen the movie The International, but it's a great example of how the wall comes down and stops your investigation.
How what comes down?
There's constantly in these things that there is you see the sort of force come down from on high and stop the honest police, the honest, you know, attorney general, and, you know, stop them cold in their tracks. And I love the movies that sort of show people how that works. But
I grew up in that family. My dad was a New York City cop who had that exact situation. He was kind of a version of like Frank Serpico, which a lot of people have heard of. My dad was like that. New York City back in the 70s. Badass cop. He worked on a lot of gangs, but also was dealing, ran into a lot of police corruption and stopped them in his tracks.
Right.
So, you know, it's a family.
I don't know, in PBS, or I think it was PBS, made it's about a 6 or 7 DVD series on New York, New York, that includes detailed description of the Triangle fire in New York and how the Al Smith rolled out the legislation really to centralize control in New York as a result of the Triangle fire. And you watch it, this thing was made in 98, and you realize, oh my God, the playbook for 9/11 is very old. They've been doing this again and again for centuries. And you literally watch it, and you're watching the script for the 9/11 bodies jumping out of the building, the burning building, for maximum impact. And you realize, wait a minute, this is, You know, this is the same exact design.
I need to look into that. That's very...
You do. You need... Everybody needs to see that one, because I was watching it and I said, oh my God, I can't believe they left this on the market. But it's, you know, because so much of these things have become reality TV. You know, you're basically making a movie. You're designing and filming a movie, except it's live. And, you know, so much of the scripts, when you say, you know, in the old ones in Paris look like the, you know, the latest, it's because these scripts are used again and again and again.
Right. Well, finding out how far back some of these goes is an interesting thing. I mean, one thing that is ancient about false flags, there's a concept that I've introduced in this book, which I just call ideological false flags. So, for example, the war on terror, I consider an ideological war, false flag. The war on communism, or the red terror back in, you know, the teens and 20s would be ideological. The Inquisition is an ideological false flag. So, in other words...
Right.
That, I think, is something that goes back through ancient history, where you're creating, you create a fake enemy, and you use that to siphon money out of the population and to attain more power. The Inquisition is a perfect example, where you create this fiction of all these witches, mostly women, who have to be subdued, and what they would actually do to the families of the women who were accused and often executed of witchcraft is they would... the church would tell the families, well, if you give this amount of money, it will shorten her time in purgatory, or it'll shorten her time, it'll lessen her eternal punishment. And this went on for centuries in the Middle Ages. So this idea of the ideological false flag, I mean, has existed forever.
Right.
And I consider it a form of, it's a kind of a form on the spectrum of propaganda. Like I was asking, like, where does a false flag fit, and how is it distinguished from other forms of manipulation? Because the term does get tossed out there a lot, and what I'm trying to do, and I don't know if I've fully succeeded yet, is understanding how it is distinguished from just other types of lies. You know, and I think I consider the false flag, it's a type of propaganda. And
it's an inventing of a false reality.
Right, which propaganda kind of does also, but it's a violent it's like the Rolls Royce of propaganda. It's like the ultimate tool in the toolkit. And this is why, by the way, I think the United States has kind of a lock on, I was talking about Mossad, but really it's the US that has become the master of doing this, because I think the United States has the most capability and the most global reach for its own propaganda system. So that when, like, I mean, think of it this way: like if some smaller country, Brazil, wanted to do a false flag that went beyond its borders, let's just say Brazil wanted to do a false flag against some other country, they would have a hard time necessarily making it stick, because there would be a lot of independent eyes looking in and critiquing it. And I mean, if you get caught doing a false flag, that's really, really a bad situation for you. In the case of the United States has so much domination over the global media and over its allies as well. I think this is key. And the United States still has the ability to intimidate basically everyone of its allies. So that when the United States does something like that, A, no one's really going to be inclined to speak up, and B, the U.S. has got the media working with them. Even if there's an alternative media, even people like us, the ABC and NBC and Fox and NPR, I mean, they're all on board. All of them are on board.
Well, it's interesting. I saw in Washington when I was, you know, when I was having my squabble with the feds, they had a couple of newspapers coming at us. And what was interesting is they would just print lies. You know, it was like facts did not matter whatsoever. And one of the things they were trying to argue was that I was laundering money we were doing billion-dollar loan sales for HUD. So they were arguing I was laundering money. And I had the company set up so that once a month all of our cash flows were published. All the employees had been with us for a certain time were shareholders. So they got to see the cash flows monthly. So there was no secret in the money. And then every check had to have two signatures, and I never signed checks. So it was the chief financial officer and one other of the partners who would sign the check. And we had a CFO who was very competent, very smart, very calm. He'd been a senior at one of the big eight firms and just got very grounded. And he came to me one morning and he said, I got up this morning and we gotten hit with a new barrage of sort of smears saying I was laundering money. And he got up and he said, I woke up this morning. I said, well, you know, maybe she is laundering money and I don't know it. And then I realized, oh, I control and manage all the money. So if you're laundering money, I'm doing it for you. And I know I'm not. But he had literally become entrained by the smear. You know, who knows all the different tactics, because it wasn't just my guess is they're probably using entrainment and other things. But, you know, there he is. He's in control of the money. He has complete command of the facts, and he's still susceptible. So it's very powerful.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, I mean, ordinary people who have ordinary levels of education and desire to appear behind things, or often with no desire, I mean, it's just like being led through the field, you know, with a ring for their collective nose. It's a horrible thing to say, but that's really how it looks. I mean, people, by and large, do not have the capability of fighting this this propaganda system unless they make a conscious decision to wake up. And your colleague, who, I mean, this is a case in point. I mean, he was being influenced by this by this propaganda barrage. I mean, it's really an unbelievable thing. I've come to feel that the idea of, propaganda as distinguished from a false flag. So propaganda exists everywhere. I mean, it exists in the United States. It exists in North Korea as a way to kind of pound an idea into the public's mind. It's a form of control, obviously. The false flag, I think, is something that we're seeing right now in this part of the world, in around the world, but as a U.S.-led thing. And I believe that the answer is because the United States right now is the the U.S. military, the United States government, basically is the leading tool for kind of global totalitarian system that is being put into place, and that the United States needs to initiate a number of events that consolidate that new system. I think that's what it is. So that, it starts with, let's say 9/11 is the centerpiece and really still, I think, remains the defining false flag of our era. I mean, you have four commercial airliners hijacked with logistical precision across the eastern U.S., outfoxing NORAD, outfoxing the U.S. Air Force, causing free fall speed disintegration, the three massive steel frame structures into pillars of dust. This has never been duplicated or repeated in the history of steel frame construction, just saying, used to justify a ready-made USA Patriot Act that transforms the nature of American society overnight. Also, justifying a ready-made invasion plan that costs trillions of dollars, I think $6 trillion into the next decade. I mean, laying waste to a large region of the world, wrecking the economic future of the U.S., and enriching certain people beyond
imagination.
And then we blame on terrorists, okay? We can say that's a world-changing false flag, and the repercussions are with us to this day. And I think will stay with us for quite a long time until we wake up to what was going on there. So that false flag, and then the many false flags that have followed, and there have been many that have followed, I think have been done primarily for the reason of implementing and consolidating a global system. In the case of the U.S. with 9/11, I think one reason it had to happen, in the opinion of most people doing it, was twofold. One, all it had to do is look back a couple of years at the Seattle riots against the World Trade Organization, which were pretty intense. If anyone has not seen video of this, I encourage them to go on YouTube and look up Seattle WTO riots, 1999. Some really intense stuff. This is back when Americans still believed they had rights, when they still believed they had, the ability to influence their government and to stop certain things. I don't want to say that we don't have them now, but back then people could have that dream. And I think, this is just my own personal take on it, but I think that that event really sent a chill and really frightened those people at the top of our national security food chain. And I think that they said, you know, this can't happen. We need, because we're moving into a global system. And if you're going to completely obliterate the middle class by, as you have discussed many times, basically exporting the United States economy elsewhere, out to China and elsewhere where there's slave markets, you destroy the middle class. People are going to buck up against that. They're going to fight. And you can't let them believe that they have the ability to fight. So you have to beat them over the head with a stick. And that was 9/11. And then the other reason 9/11, I think, had to happen was to justify the consolidation, well, first of all, to take out Saddam Hussein, who was selling his oil in euros. That couldn't be allowed. And also to control that oil and to steal the $30 trillion worth of oil that I think was under the ground there, which they did.
Right.
They did all of it.
Right. I don't know if I ever told you about the I think I told you the church story about how when I first moved to the South, I joined a small church, Southern Baptist Convention Church, and every month or so we'd get a highly political sermon. The pastor was very interested in politics and very sort of up on current events. And every time I'd get one of these sermons, I would call Kelly Amir, who was in Washington, reporter in Washington, and I'd say, you know, Kelly, I just heard we're going to do this or that. And she said, how can you know that? My best source at the FBI just called and leaked that to me. How can you know that? And this went on for a year or two. And then on September 9th, I don't know if you remember, there were Christian girls who were ministering the gospel in Afghanistan and had been arrested. And I got to church and there was a very political sermon that basically said, you know, that the relationship between Islam and Christianity had come to a head and the solution was to go to war. And first we were going to go to Afghanistan and then Iraq. And then it was Syria, Libya, and Iran. September 9th, they laid out the whole battle plan. I don't know if you've ever seen that film of Wesley Clark at the Pentagon where they lay out the whole battle plan. So I called Kelly. So this is September 9th. I called Kelly and I said, Kelly, you know, we're going to war in Afghanistan. And she said, it was the first time she hadn't had a link. She said, I haven't heard a word. I said, I'm telling you, we're going to war in Afghanistan. Then we're going to go to Iraq. Then we're going to go, you know, I laid out all the different countries. It was, you know, what was it? Five countries or nine
what
countries in 5 years.
I think he said seven, I'm thinking. He mentions Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, that's four. He mentioned Iran, that was on S5. I think there's others.
Yeah, it was the same battle plan. It was the same thing.
So how did your pastor know about all of it?
You know, I've never asked him. I've never wanted to go down that rabbit hole with him. And I later left the church, but it was very interesting because on September, you know, so Kelly woke me up on Tuesday morning to say they're attacking the you know, the World Trade Center. And, you know, until then, I had been a researcher helping reporters. I'd never really written anything. And I got so furious that everybody fell for it. I wrote a story called Cui Bono on September 17th and published it in Narco News. And that's when Al Giordano at Narco News asked me to write Narco Dollars for Beginners. And then I started publishing. And the next thing you know, I'm writing the stuff. And that led to the Salieri Report. So you could say 9/11 started... The Salieri Report. Anyway, but that Wednesday, which was September 12th, I was riding my bicycle around the town common, and I realized, oh, it's prayer service. So I went into church. So that's evening Wednesday, the day afterwards, and the pastor walked up to the podium, and he said, George W. Bush has been anointed by God for a time such as this. And I put my head in my hands, and I said, I started to pray. I said, Lord, give me a sign, you know, because I don't believe in just mouthing off. It doesn't work. It's not effective. So I just started praying, Lord, you know, give me a sign. Help me. I need divine intervention. And just at that minute, my pastor said, Austin, you know, that's my middle name, Austin, you worked in Washington. What do you think? Now, for my pastor to ask me at that time, that is divine intervention. And I said to myself, well, you know, if you ask for it, you got to perform. So I said, well, in my experience, the Bushes are anointed by pedophilia, narcotics trafficking, and financial fraud. And the whole church went, and my pastor, who just freaked, looked at me and he said, if that's the case, we're lost. And I said, don't be ridiculous. We're not lost. We have a governor. His name is God. We don't need the Bushes and the Clintons. People like the Bush and Clintons come and go. And there was another one person in the in the congregation who was a big Democrat, and she said, "Yeah!" And it was funny. It, like, broke the trance. And for until that August, the next August, I was, like, persona non grata. My cousin kept, like, pinning yellow ribbons on me. You know, she was afraid I was going to be tarred and feathered and run out of town. And then what happened was two things. First of all, the day after, all the African Americans thought it was a false flag. So you had a complete divide between the whites and the blacks. But then in the following August, it came out that the National Security Council knew that about the danger of planes flying into buildings, hadn't warned anybody.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right. And that's when the whole thing.
They were doing war games that day.
Right.
Which was a serious confusion. I mean, what are the odds, you know, that war games had to do with the exact event that happened, you know, terrorists hijacking airliners and crashing them into buildings was actually a thing that they were looking at that very day as a war game. And then you have this actual thing happening. I mean, I never hear this being discussed in our establishment media. One of the things, by the way, I came across Wesley Clark's thing. It's Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. That's seven.
Okay, so it was actually a slightly different lineup, but very similar. So they were planning on basically military intervention to control the Middle East.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
Right.
One of the things that I feel is important for us to recognize about false flags, whether they're military or whether they're – they don't have to be military. You have bombings that take place. You've got shootings that take place. You've got you've got a disease scares that I actually am wondering, you know, how many of these are false flags. In all cases, what I'm finding is, like, when something happens, you have immediate – or near immediate uniformity by the establishment media, where they are guiding people, I mean explicitly guiding them to a certain conclusion as to what's happening. I mean, they get into the front row and they are manipulating. And it's not always media, it's also the academic scientific community. Regarding 9/11, for example, on September 14th, 3 days later, I have a PDF of this, so I'm not looking at it at the moment, but I've got it. The very first engineering paper was published that attempted to explain why the World Trade Center towers collapsed as they did. Now, 3 days after they collapsed, here's a published paper that said, that purports to say, yes, here's how the towers collapsed. And he put forth what became known as the pancaking theory, which has been discredited since then. But now, I'm not an engineer or a physicist, but I have read the paper, and I can spot BS when I read it, and I can see when someone's inserting numbers that there's no justification for this whatsoever. The real larger question is, why would someone feel a need to justify why those two towers would have to fall the way that they did within 3 days and then publish it immediately?
Right.
To me, that's a deeply suspicious thing. So right away, you get these people coming out and sort of like throwing this into the narrative and providing the pretext for, you know, an official explanation. It's very, very suspicious. The other thing I just want to say about 9/11, my little pet topic of 9/11 isn't the explosions themselves, it's the anthrax scare that followed in the wake of it. And if there's anyone out there who still doubts that 9/11 was a false flag, take a look at the anthrax scare. Because what you find is that throughout the immediate aftermath of 9/11, going through October, through the debate over the USA Patriot Act, what was front row center of our media actually wasn't 9/11, it was anthrax. Because that was the thing that was happening. That was the two in the 1-2 punch. And when the anthrax letters were mailed and where they were being discussed, it was all through October of 2001. The letters were explicitly tying the anthrax to Islamic fundamentalists. Like, the first letter that went out said, 9/11, first 9/11, now this, death to Israel, death to America, Allah is great. So that was a letter that was along with the first received anthrax. And all throughout the anthrax scare, you had President Bush, you had, I think, Rumsfeld, I think Condoleezza Rice, all of them were ascribing the anthrax either to Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, if you can believe it. They actually at one time tried to connect him to that. And then on another occasion, simply Islamic fundamentalists or terrorists. So you could see where this was going. The USA Patriot Act passed on October, I think it was October 24, 2001. The following day, came the first news media report that said, oh, this anthrax appears to have come from a United States biological weapons laboratory. So it's the following day. Now, this is significant for many reasons. First of all, because the anthrax was a specific tool used in the passage of the USA Patriot Act, which has been, to say, is the most revolutionary, most fascist revolutionary law that we've passed in our nation's history. I mean, it changed everything.
I call it the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act.
Well, I want to hear you explain that, actually. but with the anthrax thing, once it came out that anthrax was actually highly weaponized, incredibly sophisticated, well beyond anything Al-Qaeda or any other group could have had, it was only a U.S. biological laboratory. Obviously, that changes the complexion of the entire thing. So my question would be, who wrote the letter? Who wrote the letter, you know, Allah is great, death to America? If this anthrax comes from a U.S. biological lab and it's being sent out with a letter that says death to America, death to Israel, Allah is great, first 9/11, now this, explicitly, all right? So that's a clear false flag.
Right.
And it's tied with 9/11. It's intimately connected to 9/11. And I think it's years now. It's how many years? 14 years into this nightmare. It's successful. I mean, it just...
One of the things that I think is very important to the evolution of false flags, which I would encourage you to look into, is I've become convinced, you know, once upon a time when you did a false flag like the Swedes did in the 1700s, you know, you paid money to cause something that, you know, a war, such thing that you thought you were going to make money on. But it was the thing that you were inspiring that was going to make your money, not the event itself. And one of the things I think that has really taken the capacity to a whole new level is Americans have figured out how to make money on the false flag in addition to the thing they're trying to inspire. So I think 9/11 was in and of itself enormously profitable. You know, the false flag itself made them a fortune, not to mention all the things it inspired that also made them another fortune. So
you refer to the insurance policy on the Trade Center?
I think that's tiny. I think the trading in the currency in the long bond markets. The insider trading. I also think it allowed the Fed to open the floodgates and pump a lot of money into the markets. That made a lot of people money. I was driving around in the city of London in a beautiful Jaguar with a money manager 2 or 3 weeks later. I was over there for an investment conference, and a client called in on the speakerphone and the Brit money manager said, you know, I'm so sorry. I know you probably lost colleagues and friends. And he said, oh, don't apologize. We're making a fortune. This is the best thing that's ever happened to us. You know, because the Fed was just pumping, pumping, pumping. Okay, so before we switch from 9/11, anything else on 9/11?
No, I mean, there's always more to say about 9/11. here's what I would say about 9/11. And this is a significant power of false flags, which is what they do is they get emotional buy-in. And, think about these events. This is the psychology of a false flag that makes them really, really effective. So some horrible thing happens, whether it's 9/11 or there's the Boston Marathon bombing or some other terrible thing where people are dying. And I mean, it's a human tragedy. And we all, everyone sees what's happened, and everyone will cry and will be upset. And we're releasing these deep emotions about the event, right? So then what happens with a well-done false flag is that you have the conceptual piece of it comes into play, and that's courtesy of the political establishment and the establishment media. And they tell you that bad thing was done by that group of people. They did it. They did it. They did it. And you hammer that in. And so what happens is that your emotional reaction becomes intimately and indelibly associated with that group. So this is the emotional buy-in. And once, I believe that once that happens, it becomes very difficult. It's very hard for people to disentangle that. It's very hard for them to look at something like 9/11 with an emotional detachment because, I mean, most of us were just not wired that way. You know, when you experience something profoundly upsetting and then you have a solution, your tendency is to hang on to that solution. And that is why we're now 14 years after 9/11 and counting. It'll be 14 years in another couple of weeks, I guess. But we've been into this a long time. And the emotional tie-in, I think a psychologist could probably explain this phenomenon much better than I could. But I think that, you know, after a certain period of time, you internalize this belief system and it becomes part of you and it becomes very difficult for most people to revisit that. And then on top of that, of course, institutionally, just imagine, you know, there was that movie V for Vendetta where the very, very perceptive question was asked by the police chief to his subordinate. He says, just imagine, you know, that you were to learn that the most awful, most horrible terrorist event that has happened in your lifetime was done by your own government. He said, the question is, would you want to know about it? Would you want to know? And it's a good question because since 9/11, the entire institutional structure, the entire psychological foundation of this country, all of those have changed fundamentally.
Right.
And everything is now based on that event. And so to revisit that event means to revisit what has now been nearly a full generation since then. I mean, I think 25% of the American population now has been living basically in a post 9/11 world. You know,
right.
And a lot of the people who were alive back then, they're gone. And so it's really the 9/11 footprint is really permanent now. And so for us to remove it's such a huge event if we have to do that.
Although it's funny, I looked at a bibliography of work on 9/11. And if you look at the amount of both video and written documentation that proves, you know, that the official story is complete bunk, it's overwhelming. I mean, and it's overwhelming. And a tremendous number of people have seen it and I think believe it. So especially, you know, the interesting thing about 9/11, it happened in Washington and New York, where you have populations who are very sophisticated about money and can, you know, and are trained to watch the money. So I
right.
think that was one of the dangers they took. And it's one of the reasons that the 9/11 story is never quite struck, because you had too many people watching the money and being irritated as, you know, a small group of people made a fortune from it. So, you know, I don't think the 9/11 story has ever quite gone with the population that was alive and adult at that time. I think the next generations are another matter. Now, can I ask you about school shootings? Because school shootings are, I think, a series of false flags that are a very interesting phenomena. And more often than not, I've seen boomerang not work.
I look at these as well. I haven't yet gotten to the point in my research where I've really analyzed them. I've got them pinned for, you know, their place in the book, and I certainly will be dealing with them. And I am inclined, as you seem to be, to look at these in a very suspicious way. The one, you know, there was just the verdict for the Aurora, Colorado shooting, James Holmes, and now that's a really deeply suspicious one. Actually, a lot of them are. In his case, this was a guy who was being treated by, I think it was a Navy psychiatrist, and he was being given all kinds of psychopharmaceuticals, behavior enhancements, and who the hell knows what else was going on with this guy.
Right.
It really reminds one of Sirhan Sirhan, who, you know, had no memory, claimed to have no memory of what he did. And I think Holmes seems to fit that very well. He seems to have the same kind of profile as a Sirhan Sirhan, in some ways, anyway.
Well, I live in the South, and, you know, and I'm a card-carrying gun owner. And what you've seen happen all across the South is the more the school shootings occur, the more the South concludes everybody needs to buy a gun. So.
Yeah, well, listen, I know there are many cases of such shootings being thwarted by private citizens who have their own gun. You never hear about that
right.
in the news, but that happens.
Right.
That does happen. And think about it. If you're going to go into a crowded movie theater and you know everyone's got a weapon, maybe you might think twice.
Well, there's been lots of lore on the internet saying that, in fact, now with some of the school shootings that media interviews of teachers and parents is interviewing actors, not real people.
I've been hearing.
Do you have any opinion on that yet?
Some of these look very suspicious, actually. Again, this is something that I will be really looking into more seriously. But yes, some of them look like crisis actors. For example, there's a woman who was associated with the Sandy Hook event, who was also, her picture, I believe, was used at for a shooting, believe it or not, that took place in another country, and I want to say Pakistan. And I'm going off the top of my head with this, but some of these, I mean, you know, Sandy Hook really is the one where you get a lot of these claims about crisis actors. And,
right.
There's the father, the alleged father, I guess it was the father of one of the kids who, before the cameras are rolling but was being recorded otherwise, was seen seemingly in a very lighthearted mood. And then suddenly when he knows the cameras are on him, it kind of like changes his whole demeanor. It is very odd. I mean, I can tell you, as the father of two children, if I had lost a young child at an elementary school, there is not a chance that I would have a smile on my face in any way for weeks and months on end. It just wouldn't happen. I know that, and I can probably say most vast majority of parents would probably be that way. This is a very odd thing. One thing that I would say about these shootings, you know, you said cui bono after 9/11, and we have to ask this of all of them. In terms of the shootings, it's not simply gun control or gun regulation. That is one agenda, I think. And whether it's false flag or just pure state opportunism, and sometimes there is opportunism, and it's not always a false flag. But it could be a false flag, and it could be for gun control. But the other aspect of it, without a doubt, is psychological profiling of mental health screening. So
right.
I get this after Sandy Hook. There's this huge kind of movement now for everyone to have, like, you know, their mental health screening. It's really what you find is just another way for the state to get into your medical records and to have you psychologically profiled as part of the control system. One other thing I want to mention, I mentioned opportunism a moment ago, and this is probably the most difficult thing looking at false flags, is like distinguishing, an intentional event or an event that happens that governments are actually very happy to have had happen that they use for their benefit. And, you get people talking about 9/11 like this. They'll say, well, the government didn't do it, but they were happy to use 9/11 as a pretext for the wars that they've done. Naomi Klein in The Shock Doctrine basically makes this type of argument, and she does a really good job, by the way. I like her book a lot. What she argues is that it's not really dissimilar in a lot of ways to what you and I have been talking about many occasions, so that she argues that the U.S. government has become very adept at using dramatic events that occur with ready-made plans to roll out and to, it's when a society is in a state of shock, when something traumatic happens, that is when you have your opportunity to do dramatic, even draconian changes that you've been wanting to implement for a while. And she calls that the shock doctrine. So her take on it, I think, is more of she's looking at opportunism, and she doesn't really go down the false flag rabbit hole so much. She may, for all I know, credit certain false flags. I'm sure she probably would, but that's really not her focus. But I do think, like, the principle of a shock doctrine really is applicable.
Right.
You know,
well,
or false flag.
I don't know if you've ever heard my Indonesian tsunami story, but I am convinced that we have the technological capability to induce earthquakes and tsunamis. And if you look at the speed and the infrastructure set up to take advantage of some of these events, it's too professional, it's too thorough, and it's too fast for it to be just taking advantage of the event. It has to have been pre-planned.
Right. And this is one of the things that we have to look for with false flags is the speed, the rapidity of the response. This is another
right.
thing where you have the identification of the culprit or the identification of the problem, and then, boom, an immediate reaction. And when that happens, think about, like, Boston. You know, when you have nearly 20,000 militarized police on that Friday, within days of this, going through the homes of residents of Boston. I mean, how do you organize that many militarized police? I mean, honestly, the logistics is staggering.
Right. Right.
Another thing that I notice with these false flags is the creation of slogans. It's almost like they come out of Madison Avenue. Like in the case of Boston, Boston Strong. Boston Strong. Really, Boston? You weren't strong? I don't think so. Not that day. I mean, I love Boston.
Well, I think you have the equivalent of producers and directors. I think this is a staged media event, and it's the equivalent of making a movie. And you have companies that literally their business is reality TV shows, and a part of their business is not just making it for TV, it's making false flags.
Well, the question would be identifying these individuals, and I have not been able to do that. But, I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. I agree with you. I mean, all of the tools are there, and they exist better in the United States than anywhere else. You know, the ability to create these types of false realities, the ability to enforce your will over the population, over other countries. The U.S. has got all of that. And, what we need is really good, independent journalists, brave people who are willing to go in and look into these types of questions and try to identify a production company that might be involved in, say, Boston,
right.
or might be involved in any of the shootings.
Let me bring up one phenomena that I think is very important to the creation of this capacity. We're literally watching, for the last 20 years, a shift out of a world where it's only sovereign states that control armies and the ability to implement these kind of operations. So you have governmental intelligence agencies and within the what's called the Westphalian system. And we're moving towards a much more multipolar world where it's almost back to the medieval ages, where you have private armies and private mercenaries, some of which work for sovereign states, but some just work for companies or, you know, large church organizations or large NGOs. And you're building an enormous capacity to implement these operations, whether it's the media side or the force side, you know, basically with private mercenaries and armies, and it's multiplying the capacity tremendously.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And so we're moving it into an era of corporate, not national control. And I imagine that the question you're moving toward is, are we looking at an era of maybe corporate-promoted false flags? I don't know. Is that what you're asking, as opposed to
national? Where I'm really going is I think the breakaway civilization has enormous capacity, both media and covert capacity, using government and non-governmental. But I think, you know, if you look at who they may be and their resources, they can implement cross-sector globally, you know, in phenomenal ways.
Yeah. I mean, for example, when you start looking at not simply United States false flags, but but international. I'm just thinking at random, the Mumbai, there were Mumbai attacks in 2008. I was just looking at this recently. You said gunmen who stormed the Taj Mahal Palace, the bloody kind of encounter that goes on for several days, the siege. A lot of people are killed. And the official narrative was that these are Pakistani terrorists belonging to some tribe. And in reality, these were Israeli Indian terrorists carrying out a false flag to frame Pakistan. That's a national one, but then there are ones that are international. And there's the Bali bombing of 2002, which I think was a way to get Australia into the war on terror. You've got I'm not really answering the questions you have here. You've got there was the Madrid bombings in 2004. There was the London bombings in 2007. I think these might be speaking to the type of thing you're talking about. Where you've got this group behind the scenes, let's call them breakaway civilization, that is looking at all of these different nations and saying, we need to implement a global series of legal revolutions globally. It has to be done in the United States, it's got to be done in Britain, it's got to be done in Spain, it's got to be done everywhere. And I think that there's a possibility that there's coordination at a higher level. There's definitely been a piling on effect. Like after 9/11, one thing I noticed is that other nations, Egypt, in one place, Macedonia, I mean, even they did false flags as a way to get U.S. money in the war on terror. And that's certainly what it looks like. So that's like a kind of a piling on.
It's interesting how much of this is designed to swing popular opinion or to get popular opinion to stand down when you do something that is not popular, and which is why I think it is so powerful if you can significantly raise the consciousness globally about these games and stuff. Because if they just stop working, if everybody starts laughing and rolling their eyes and not taking any of it seriously, no matter how horrible it is, it could really shift things.
Absolutely. People have got to be aware of what these things are about. And not all the false flags are violent. I'm thinking of the so-called hack on Sony that was supposedly done by North Korea.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
This is, I think, very, very obviously looking like a false flag, a frame-up against North Korea. I mean, they're such an easy target. No one likes them. It's a horrible place to live. But really what you find is that this hack, there's a lot of CIA connections throughout all of this when you start looking into it. And, again, it's the result. What you get is you have President Obama, pushing for much greater government federal involvement in corporate internet traffic to protect corporations. In other words, a much more intimate kind of association between government and corporations. Really, it's the definition of fascism.
Have you ever looked at the OPM hack? Is there any? Because that's one of the ones I wondered about, the OPM hack.
When and where? I'm so sorry. I'm not
OPM.
Well, or I'm missing.
Sorry, the OPM hack was the Office of Personnel Management about 2 months ago.
Recently.
Yeah.
Just recently. No, I am looking into this. I'm at the collection stage in this right now. But my attitude with any of these hacks is none of this can be taken at face value. It's just impossible.
Right.
So when you when you read the mainstream narrative, the only thing you can really be sure of is that this is what they want you to believe. I mean, that's literally it. So this is, you have to start from there. So you're being told, look in this direction. This is the narrative tells you. And then that's your starting point. And then you have to start looking in other directions. But no, I think there's very likely a significant backstory to it. I haven't really delved into it yet.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk with you about, Richard, I've been very concerned because what I've found is the more the general credibility of government deteriorates, One of the problems I run into is you have the general population, and I find our subscribers are very intelligent, very capable people, very grounded people, but yet they fall prey to what I call fear porn, all sorts of, you know, predictions and scenarios that clearly make no sense whatsoever. But in an environment where you have government running around and doing these things, you start to realize, you know, you start to feel like, okay, well, you know, any of these clearly ridiculous, what I call adult fairy tales, well, maybe they could happen. Maybe they, you know, and you start believing everything. And one of the things, one of the reasons I wanted to talk with you about false flags is if we're coming into a period, September, October, November, when a lot of big geopolitical decisions are going to be made. And a lot of interesting things are going to happen. So, for example, in September in New York, you're going to have the president of Russia, France, China, the United States, and the Pope all together at the UN announcing a global development agenda. You know, it's just a very intense time. Yeah. And one of the things I've been worried about is so many different predictions of different disasters this fall.
I'm hearing
so,
them all the time myself. I'm hearing one prediction after another. And for
right.
September, October, yeah.
And it's gotten yeah. ludicrous.
Just, no, we all can see that the global system is actually, I mean, it's teetering. And I think you see this better than I do, better than most of us. And there could be something that happens in the fall. So.
Well, here's what I think it's doing, because I don't think it's teetering. I think we use the bond market to generate an enormous amount of economic activity that didn't have fundamental economics behind it. And, you know, so that's kind of like a pump, and now they're bringing it down. It's deflating in. And so all these different companies or worlds are collapsing back in. It's a little bit like the Tower of Babel. And
I'm just looking at the BRICS challenge. You know, China just made another announcement that they're trading another elimination of the dollar in their foreign trade. And, I mean, you just have all of these excessive dollars, trillions of dollars floating around the world, and if there's not a less of a demand for them globally, they're eventually going to come back here to the U.S. and with very bad repercussions. At least.
Oh, I think that the problem this fall is that if you raise interest rates, the demand's going to go up. So if anything, I mean, short run, if anything, the dollar is going to go up, and that's going to be a leash that jerks on everyone. But whatever. You know, clearly we are going through a period of unprecedented change, and it's going to continue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
in terms of the fear porn that you're talking about, I've been encountering this among readers and people that I know in my field for many years. I mean, it's never stopped. In a lot of what we call the alternative research community, one of the banes of this field are the endless supply of predictions. They never stop. And some of these predictions are truly off the wall, and yet people still find a way of believing them. And I get individuals writing to me frequently about this, and I just say, you know, look, take a breath, calm down. Human beings have lived in crisis since there have been human beings. There's never been a time of human history when there has not been some kind of crisis. It's always been
crisis. Right.
We all are born, we all live, we all die. That's every human life. So just get a grip. Secondly, in terms of whether or not to believe or disbelieve something's coming down the pike, I think it really helps to have a proper analytical approach. There are things that, I mean, I don't know the future. You don't know the future. That's not our lot. But what we can know is the structure of power as best that we can understand it and know whether certain things fit into that analytical framework or not. And then the other thing is, you know, be inclined to start looking for evidence. I mean, simply because someone makes a claim or some insider or someone who claims that authority says something does not make it true. We really do need to take a cold eye to some of this and apply rules of evidence to information that comes our way. And
right.
Take our time. Do not rush to judgment, but come slowly to judgment. I think that's just a much better policy. I mean, no, none of us is perfect. I've made mistakes. But overall, I think if you trust your analytical framework and if you are looking for evidence, then that'll get you through.
I know you and I just did your radio show on the debt issue.
Yeah.
And it's funny, one
I still wanted to get you to talk about derivatives so you could explain that to me.
Well, here's what you need to understand. A derivative is a financial interest in a financial interest. So, for example, if I own a stock in a company that owns cows, then I have a financial interest in a pool of cows. But a derivative, so if I own an option on that stock, it's a financial interest in another financial interest. It's that simple. But the important thing to understand about derivatives is that most of them were interest rate swaps that have very much been engineered to keep interest rates down. So we've never lived through a period in recorded history when we've raised interest rates into, you know, a sea of interest rate swap derivatives. And who knows how that's going to work. But one of the frightening things about it is if I'm right about the derivatives, basically the U.S. federal credit is on the hook one way or another for essentially all of them. And they have the capacity to create false flags. And I think there's a relationship between managing that book and false flags.
Man, I've got to understand derivatives a little bit better. Thank you. Homework.
I'm delighted to talk with you more about derivatives. We should do a Solera report on derivatives. It's kind of a
them all the time, and I just feel like I feel lost. I'm not a financial whiz. I admit it.
Well, think of it this way: it is a way to use the financial system to lock in the future. So if you want to go to the right, you lock all the derivatives up to go to the right. And if everybody tries to go to the left, you say, well, we can't go because that'll, you know, mess up the derivatives.
All right.
It's kind of a way of engineering.
Introduction. I have many, many rivers to cross when it comes to that. But
well, one of the things that I see is, you know, if you look at all the possibilities of what you could research for this book, it's tremendous. But I really think that the world needs a general introduction and framework to false flags because the capacity is growing to implement them. And I think the only way you can shift that is with more greater consciousness so that these things, you know, the more the population has an immunity, the safer we are from them.
I completely agree. One thing I'll say, I don't know how much more time we have, but I will just mention, I believe the creation of ISIS is fundamentally a false flag. I mean, it's a complex creation of that organization, Islamic State, but I think we can say that qualifies as an actual false flag. And the false flag that I'm actually worried about, and I've been worried about this on and off for some time, and I still think it can happen, would be a false flag to implicate the nation of Iran in some kind of event that would justify an invasion of that nation. And I mean, I hope it doesn't happen, but this is a false flag that I could see actually taking place in the near future to justify some awful thing.
Oh, and to sorry. Stop the is it would it be designed to stop the deal from finally being approved?
It would be in order to take over the natural gas reserves in that country, in my opinion, which are the second largest natural gas reserves in the world, next to Russia.
Right.
I think. You know, the U.S. had Iran for a long time. They lost Iran in the late 70s, and they've been wanting that sucker back ever since, and they're concocting. I think the whole nuclear thing is a complete red herring. What is Iran's nuclear threat to the world? I mean, it's essentially zero. It's essentially zero. And this has been turned into a huge thing to force them to the table and there is a danger. You've got these crazy, primarily Republicans in Congress who are opposed to this deal with Iran. They want to make it even tougher, and they're very much inclined to scotch the deal. And if the deal is killed, this is not a good thing for prospects of peace in the Middle East, in my opinion. And if it does go down, if it is killed, for all I know, and I'm just guessing here, but that could make it easier for a pretext of a false flag implicating Iran. Right now, the plan, U.S. has a plan that would, I just read this recently, I think something like, U.S. has a nuclear plan against Iran, so that's one thing that has to be said. There's a nuclear option against that nation using low-yield bunker buster missiles that would hit hundreds of targets in that country. But if the U.S. goes to war against Iran, they have no ability to occupy the nation. They can't do that. It's too big. What they would do is a massive strike and just obliterate much of its infrastructure. And it would be a completely horrible crime against the world and against that nation. But I think that the prize is the natural gas, and I mean certainly the oil, clearly, but the natural gas is becoming a bigger and bigger prize. And Iran's reserves are enormous natural gas reserves. Ungodly.
Well, there's something else, Richard. I mean, grossly oversimplified, if you look at what happened after 9/11, we made an effort to go in and reorganize control and management of the Middle Eastern oil reserves, and we spent many times the budget, and we didn't get the job done. And I think that's one of the reasons that ISIS is happening. But as a financial matter, if that happens in Iran, you will then have the U.S. financially significantly overextended and exposed financially in a way that could be disastrous. So
if ISIS expands, you're saying?
Part of the challenge is if you look at the post 9/11 strategy, it was a financial failure. In other words, they didn't get their military goal accomplished. And if you look at what happened financially, it wrecked the house. And so now
I agree with you, but they did, at least in the immediate term, they were able to sell off those Iraqi oil fields. I mean, those had all been under Iraqi state control. And by, I think, 07 or so, they were pretty much all sold off, almost at fire sale prices to international buyers, by the way, not all American. Now, those are at risk, clearly, because of the destabilization of that country, and it's turning into a failed state. It could be that the plan for Iraq is to break it into several different nations, along with Syria, obviously, as part of the plan to take them out, turn it into Yugoslavia, and just balkanize it and run your own criminals in there. That could be. I think that's actually what they want to do. I think they want to break Iraq into pieces. They want to break Syria. Turkey wants a piece. I think everyone's going to get a piece of that action. And then they'll be able to run their natural gas pipeline through as well to the Mediterranean. Basically, what they're trying to do is run natural gas around Russia. So Russia's feeding natural gas to Europe. And the U.S. goal has been, well, how the heck do we get around Russia? There's one that might go through Turkey from, I think, Tajikistan, I think, down to Turkey. That would work, but a better one actually would go from Iran through Iraq through Syria. That's the so-called friendship pipeline or the Islamic pipeline. And I think the U.S. wants – they either want to stop
it. I agree. They want to be able to supply Europe with everything Europe needs without Russia.
Right, exactly.
Right.
So and if they need to do a false flag to take – to do regime change in Iran, then, I mean, they'll do it.
Well, one way or another, it's going to be an interesting fall.
What do the Chinese say? May you live in interesting times. That's the curse. And there are days, honestly, where I just would love for things to be nice and boring.
Yes.
And there are days when I just think, can I just enjoy Monday Night Football or can I just watch some sports or American Idol? But I can't do it. I'm not constitutionally able to do that sort of thing. And you have to look into these things. It's this compulsion. But I don't want to say that I love it or that I hate it, but it's just like I have to do it.
Well, here's the thing. You have a growing population and a shrinking resource base. And we either are going to change or we're going to have more conflict. It's a pretty simple framework. And that's why I keep asking the question, as you do, who's really in control? And, you know, why are they behaving the way they're behaving? Because it always seems to me that there's a better way. But Well, I think it comes down to
why are revolutionary technologies continually being withheld from the rest of us? And I think that this
right.
is really a key question. And you know, hopefully as a society, we'll get to a point where we can ask these a little more openly. That is, within the black budget world, there are technologies, there are sciences that are known that would make, I think, that would make petroleum obsolete anyway. I know that's a radical thing to say, but I think that it's true. And, you know, keeping in mind, for anyone who thinks that that's an outrageous statement, just remember how vastly ahead the classified world has been continually ahead of us in terms of computing technology, in terms of, well, that alone, it's been very far ahead. But when you have the spotters over at places like Area 51 looking at craft making impossible types of maneuvers, these are very well documented. We've got technologies that are off the books.
Right.
And they're using a form of energy that I think is not petroleum.
Right.
And so if you get a post-petroleum future, we're looking at a really fundamentally different paradigm. And
right.
maybe a better one.
Right.
It could be.
Right. So there's no economic reason why we need to be dependent on fossil fuels.
I don't think there should be, no. And right. and fossil fuels are whatever we see in terms of our future as a society, as a civilization, do we really think that fossil fuels are going to get us there? I mean it's just not it can't be.
Right. Right.
So 300 years
right.
now, obviously fossil fuels, driving a car, no. There's going to
no.
be something much more advanced. So we need to get that now. And I believe that a lot of those answers actually exist with us already, and they're being hidden back, withheld.
Well, I just have to, since the false flag book is not available, I have to make a plug for UFOs for the 21st Century Mind. I've certainly
Thank
told
you.
The subscribers enough times that they absolutely have to read it, but you explore all the different aspects of the phenomena, including the fact that we have managed as a society to put up a wall and on one side keep all this phenomenal technology, you know, just on that one side and a secret to everything on the other side. It's quite amazing how it's been engineered and the
yeah,
implications it has.
Well, the thing
yeah,
about the UFO thing, I mean, people will look at UFOs and think, oh, that's silly. What relevance does it have? When we're talking about things like false flags or 9/11, that's more important. And what I would just say is, well, those are very important. But people, I think, tend to underestimate the importance of the UFO phenomenon because they just haven't looked into it. And they associate it with fun and games. But think of that as a propaganda effort made against you. You've had 60, 70 years now of propaganda telling you that this is a silly topic. So maybe, just maybe, you should step back and ask yourself, why am I being told that this is silly, actually?
Right.
Maybe you need to take a look at this a little more carefully. And when you look at the implications of the technology, the implications of military national security, which are endemic to this, and the implications of cutting-edge science that phenomenon actually intersects with, whether it's propulsion or energy, space-time or consciousness itself, all of these are affected by the UFO phenomenon. Any topic that intersects with that many leading-edge issues is probably of profound significance, which I think it is, and politically cover up all of it. It's quite important. Whether that means aliens or not aliens is secondary. The fact that
right.
the phenomenon is a real thing, and it's a big part of our world.
Right. Okay, well, Richard, before we close, could you just remind everybody how they can find you and how they can follow your work?
Yes, absolutely. I have a website, richarddolanpress.com. You can write to me through that. I have those books and articles by myself there and by other authors that I publish. It's a small but growing publishing venture. I've got a number of new books coming out that are actually fantastic by great authors. That'll be out this summer. Or fall. And I'm very active on Facebook, actually. I'm easy to find. I'm usually maxed out with my friends, but you can always be a follower. And I feel like the Jerry Seinfeld of Facebook is like, I've got this great cast of people around me
uh-huh.
to preside over my awesome little Facebook universe. So I've got really brilliant people coming to my wall and posting things. And I kind of manage it. I police it best I can. I also do a weekly radio show, which you appeared on recently, every Monday
uh-huh.
night, 8 to 10 Eastern, on KGRA Radio. It's just called the Richard Dolan Show. And That's basically, I keep myself very...
And next year, on April 30th, you will be at the 21 Club addressing a wonderful group of Solari subscribers.
Oh, love it. I really enjoyed meeting Solari subscribers with you at the 21 Club this year. I'll be glad, very happy to come back.
Okay, Richard, thank you so much. Keep us posted on when the book is available, and we'll let the subscribers know. And I look forward to reading it. And if there's anything I can do to help you with the financial aspects of the research, absolutely let me know. Okay?
I will be asking you, and thank you for that offer. I appreciate it.
Have a great day.
Thanks, Catherine. Thank you so much for having me here.